Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. We are continuing in the conversation that is going to be held over the next months, probably years, in the province of Alberta around the policies that Danielle Smith has announced. She hasn't rolled them out yet. It's all very strange. We're hoping to clear some of that up tonight. But around the policies that have to do with healthcare for trans people, especially trans youth. Now, we have evidence-based this thing to death. And so instead of putting more pictures of studies up on the screen, tonight we're going to try something a little bit different. We're going to talk to somebody who actually provides healthcare for trans youth in the province of Alberta, if you could imagine such a thing. So joining us tonight from Lethbridge, where it's windy, but there shall not be any more wind power generation, we found out today. We're recording this on the 28th of February, by the way. We're very excited to be joined by physician Dr. Jillian DeMontigny.
Hello, thank you for having me, Nate. I'm really excited to be here.
Did I stick the landing?
You perfected it.
Perfect. 10 out of 10. That'll be an inside joke for the two of us that the audience just doesn't get to know about. So, Dr. DeMontigny, thank you so much for joining us today. And I mean, before we get into the big conversation where we ask the hard questions, who is Dr. Jillian DeMontigny, and how did you come to be practicing not just medicine, but what is, to many interpretations, a fairly niche form of medicine? And I'm open to being corrected on how niche it is.
All right. Well, I'm glad you asked. I love talking about who I am. So I prefer to go by Jillian. I tell my patients when I meet them for the first time, Jillian is my preferred name. My pronouns are she and her. If it makes someone more comfortable, they're welcome to call me Dr. Jillian or Dr. DeMontigny. Those are both fine as well. But Jillian's my name. And I'm a family physician, and I work in Lethbridge, as you said. And I'm also a mom and a wife and a friend and a neighbor and lots of other things. But we're here today to talk about something that affects a lot of my patients and a family member and lots of my friends. And that's gender-affirming healthcare, and in particular, whether there should be policies that come between the provider and the patient and their support network. So that's what we'll focus on, not the other aspects of who is Jillian. And how did I get into this? Well, about half of my practice now is my regular family medicine panel patients. So the ones that I see for anything you would see a family doctor for. So from prenatal care to care of the elderly to everything in between. I do that. But also about half of my time now is spent seeing patients from outside of my regular panel. So they might have another family doctor, or they might be without family doctor. Unfortunately, that's common for many Albertans right now.
In Alberta?
Yes, sir. I'm afraid so. And that's unfortunate too. But I get patients by referral from their regular provider or by patient self-referral for gender dysphoria or questions about gender or wanting to talk about what treatments might be available for medical transition. And I also do a few other things for patients outside of my panel. So not as big a amount of my time, but I provide medical abortion consults and I do pelvic floor consults, so pessary fittings and management for patients with pelvic organ prolapse. I do an opioid dependence treatment program at Prairie Treatment Clinic 2 days a month, and I see patients for HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis for patients who are at higher risk of HIV exposure. And I'm trying to think if there's any other sort of additional areas. Those are probably the main ones. I'm sorry to my patients if I forgot any of you in that basket, but I alluded to it before we got on the air, Nate, but If there's an area of care that patients come to me with that is needing to be done and we can't seem to find or get them to the person providing it, then if it's within my power, I have just taken that on. It's you can either look around and see who's doing the work and wait for someone to show up, or if it's not getting done, you can just figure out how safely to do it. And so it is still rather niche to have some things like hormone starts and puberty blocker prescriptions, but it's definitely not outside of the scope of what a family physician can do in Alberta. And so, yeah. And I would like to tell you the story of how I first got started in the gender-affirming care.
I would love, I mean, first of all, that list that you just ran down, I didn't know about the whole list when we started this conversation, and I had no idea that you were that awesome. That's fantastic. Because you're basically doing all of the medicine that so many people are saying that we desperately need in this province, and some politicians are trying to shut down. So mad props to you, but I just wanted to do that. I'm going to call you Dr. Jillian is what I'm going to do, because as some of the audience know, I do work professionally as a paramedic, and there is the I can't even begin to describe the cognitive dissonance that starts to kick up at the notion of calling a physician by their first name. Like, that's just, we'll throw the doctor in front of it, and I'll say that I made progress.
That's great. I just want you to be comfortable when we're having a conversation, Nate.
Thank you.
That's kind of my jam.
I'm getting
I
that
like
sense.
people to be, okay to talk to me. So, when I was still in my training, something happened in my family, and that was kind of pivotal in shaping just how I want to conduct myself in my work. And it was my great uncle Alphonse Irwing, wonderful man, Order of Canada recipient. There's a foundation in his honor. Like, he was great. And we loved him. And he loved us. And we didn't learn until his eulogy that he was gay. And he was advocating for his church, his religion, to recognize that people could be homosexual and still welcome members of the community. And this was a like letter writing campaign to the people in positions of ability to make some change happen, and he didn't get anywhere with it. And for me to learn as someone in medical school at the time that this man that I believed I loved well and knew well hadn't been able to be open about this really important aspect of his life and who he was just kind of really crushed my heart, but opened it up too, because I decided I can take steps to make it so that the people that I care about feel more comfortable being who they are with me, which often means telling me important things about themselves. And I try to practice that in my life, but I really try to practice that in my work life especially. And I think that might be why some 12 years ago now, a patient contacted my office at the time and asked if I would take her on my panel. As my regular patient, she needed a family doctor, but she also prefaced the call by saying, "I am trans and I want a doctor who will use my name and my pronouns when I'm there seeing her." And I said, "Okay, yeah. Tell her she can book in with me, that's fine," to the office staff. And then I got an email. "Well, here's the guidelines, the Harry Benjamin 2006 guidelines at the time for what were then what's now called the standards of care for treatment of patients with gender dysphoria." And at our first appointment, she said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I said, "No, but like what about we just start with what I do know, and I will learn over time to be the doctor that you needed me to be today." And flipping through guidelines is not a very efficient way to conduct a medical appointment. So we had a number of visits over time, and I learned some more stuff. And then more patients were sent my way because I was the girl who was doing the things with trans people. And I took every opportunity at conferences and with online training, and I went up to Calgary and shadowed with some excellent providers there, and just kind of learnt as I went, which is kind of how we often learn parts of medicine that aren't as frequently seen or commonly practiced. And so, yeah, that's my origin story.
That's awesome. And I mean, I love that you're pointing out the fact that there is no, to my knowledge, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no like the Alberta Clinic of Gender Dysphoria where they have gender dysphoriologists who practice exclusively in that field in Alberta. Is that, oh, I'm about to be corrected. Here we go.
Yeah, actually, yes, you are. So we do have a few multidisciplinary clinics that offer wraparound services for patients with gender dysphoria of varying ages. So in Calgary, there's the MediClinic, which is at Alberta Children's Hospital. So that's for patients up to age 18. Everything from mental health support, social work support, patient liaisons, pediatric endocrinology, pediatrician, pediatric psychiatry, like they're all there in one place. And it's a fantastic service. And they see a lot of kids. And there's also the adult gender program at the Foothills Health Science Center. Dr. Joe Raich is a clinical psychiatrist in both the children's and the adults programs. And yeah, he reopened the programs. They had been here in the early aughts and then they shut down for a time, I understand, and then got reopened back in 2016, I want to say. And then up in Edmonton, they have the gender program at the University of Alberta Hospital, also a multidisciplinary program. But back in my day, 12 years ago, there was Dr. Lauren Wernicke, who was a psychiatrist at the Grey Nuns Hospital in Edmonton. And that's where my very first that I knew of, I was seeing her because of gender dysphoria. She was driving from Taber to Edmonton to meet with the psychiatrist, who then referred her to an endocrinologist. And while she was waiting, and we were seeing each other in the clinic, just trying to sort of hold it together. She one day looked at me and said, "Can't you just prescribe me any of this medicine?" Like the psychiatrist had seen her and said, "Yes, she should be on hormone therapy. Could I not just?" And yeah, I think I went back in time there. Sorry.
No, that's good. I mean, the you kind of stole my point from me there. It's almost as if you're a professional or something, but the what I was trying to work towards was there's no one specialty that works on these issues. It's a multidisciplinary thing, and there's not like one title that exists in medicine for gender dysphoric care because it is so complex. And I made that point very poorly, and I totally take the correction.
It can be very complex. Yeah, and it can also sometimes be really, really simple.
Okay.
So, between you and me, there are some patients where I might see them and we might decide together that they don't actually need to see a psychiatrist, that we can just talk about hormone therapy and what we know about it so far. And generally speaking, if it's a patient whose medical background is fairly simple, we might not need an endocrinologist. I mean, none of these medications are ones that family doctors don't prescribe for other indications. So treating gender dysphoria like it's some special, mystical, additional layer of complexity is a little bit, I think, artificial. I think it comes more from a place of thinking that there's something wrong with people who are gender dysphoric rather than just seeing variation in gender identity and gender expression as part of natural human variability, what makes us all so unique and
Should it
interesting.
have a different name, do you think? Because the dysphoria part has some pronounced implications, and medical terminology is not known for being the most let's go with progressive cough, hysterectomy, cough. But do you think it should have a different name to address the fact that there is, to be clear, nothing wrong with being trans?
That's true. And trans and gender diverse people, the being of having a gender identity that's different than what you were thought to be when you were first born, that is not itself like a disease or something wrong, just like you said. And I should more rightly probably use the term gender incongruence, which is the ICD-11 terminology. So that's for a person doesn't even need to be distressed by it if they are feeling sort of comfortable with the difference between the gender they identify with and what they were assigned at birth. The dysphoria piece is kind of if someone identifies one way and they would like the world to refer to them or interact with them according to how they identify, that disconnect or difference or the world, the system is the problem and not so much the individual. So that distress, gender dysphoria. I'm sorry, I stick with it because my electronic medical record, where I do all my notes and all my billings come from, it's stuck in the old DSM-5. We don't have ICD-11 codes. And so I haven't got that step of translation to be able to say gender incongruence in my text and then go to gender dysphoria in my diagnostic code. So my
That's fair.
apologies. You're right. We shouldn't pathologize gender diversity. Diversity is wonderful and healthy, as Chris Wells so beautifully put it the other day. But the things that a person who is gender diverse might want medical treatment to achieve, not getting that can certainly cause a lot of distress for people.
For
Even
sure.
just not getting called by the name they like to be called or referred to with the pronouns that they prefer to be referred to can be quite distressing to people. I think more because that reflects that there are some people who would really like to not recognize their diversity and not show them the respect of appreciating who they are, and rather would like them to stay in your assigned closet, if you will.
Yeah, no, I mean, so here's one of the things that I wanted to ask. I have a bunch of questions that I want to ask you, but here's one of the things I wanted to ask you because I think this is one of the big myths, lies. I'm not sure what we want to call it, but there is for sure when we talk about gender diversity, there's an organic component. It's not just you woke up on a day that ended in Y and went, you know what I'd like to do today? I think I'm going to try something different. Eggs instead of cereal. I don't know. Maybe I'll just change my gender. That's not a thing that people really do. Am I wrong?
Well, don't you remember the day you decided to be who you are? Hey, no?
No, I can't say that I ever had any dissonance over that,
No.
which
And
is the luxury.
right? How fortunate those of us who are cisgender or who identify as what we were told we were, might not be as familiar with that, but I'll tell you something about me. I've heard you sort of frame your layers of privilege in the world and the space that you move in. So I'm a cisgender woman, het, heterosexual woman, and I can recall a time pre-puberty, really having a sense that things might be easier if I had been born a boy. Right. I felt like life was in some ways easier for the boys in my world. And at no point in that recognition did I think I should be a boy to access that. I didn't ever have any discomfort with the fact that although to my young mind, it was harder to be a girl. That never meant that I felt like I wasn't one. I didn't question whether I should be or shouldn't be one. It was just I knew who I was. And we know from a lot of research studies that a great majority of children from a very young age before puberty know who they are. And of those kids, there's a small number, might not be as small as we think. It depends on how recent the study and how big it is, and how affirming the world around kids is to explore notions of gender. Kids might be 1 to 3% of them that are gender diverse. You know, the gender binary, but the opposite of what they were assigned might be around 1%, but kids who are just gender expansive might be up to 2.7%, depending on what you're looking at. And so, yeah, it there is something going on. And you said organic, and I'm just going to say I don't know what it is. I just know that I listen to people when they tell me what their favorite color is, what their religious belief is, or their cultural background is. I don't see why I shouldn't listen to people when they tell me who they are in their gender. Even if the answer is, you know, Jillian, I don't know, which I see sometimes, right? I get to be exposed to lots of different people with questions around gender, and they don't all come sort of fully formed and ready. You know, I'm know what I want for this, and this for my transition. Thank you very much. Goodbye. By the way, it's never that easy. Some people are just like, I just feel like there's something gender related, and I don't know who else to talk to. And my family doctor said I should come talk to Jillian. And Jillian says, yes, come sit down. We might not figure life out in a day, but like we have the rest of your life to try and help you with those questions, right? So yeah, did I answer your question?
I think you did. I think you did. Both in technicality and spirit. So thank you for that. I want to talk about the type of care that is provided. So, and we've covered this on the show. We're going to do it again because it's just so dumb and people keep repeating dumb things. And until people stop repeating dumb things, we have to keep repeating smart things. So, puberty blockers. So
I love
let's
them.
let
They're wonderful.
I'll put it this way. There are a lot of misconceptions. There are a lot of there's a lot of rhetoric. Danielle Smith has proposed in her policies that puberty blockers shouldn't be available for anyone under the age of 15, which I have so many questions. Fortunately, I have a doctor in front of me today that I get to ask him to. But in the broadest sense, what are puberty blockers and what, if any, are the risks of puberty blockers?
Excellent. I love this question. So we have one main puberty blockers, and then we have a few other things that do a little bit of blocking of certain things, but don't block all of the changes of puberty. So generally speaking, we're talking about medicine that is going to affect the hormones so that whatever the body was going to do or no, is starting to do, because they're only ever used when someone's already started puberty change, right? We never put someone on puberty blockers for gender questions. They are used for precocious puberty, but again, puberty has started then. So puberty started, and someone's saying, wait, my kid is having some difficulty. They're telling us this change in their body isn't right for them. We've been talking with the mental health worker and they sent us to you, Jillian. What do we do? Medicine that we can give that tells the body to stop making estrogen or testosterone. And that shut off can bring the hormone levels back down to a prepubertal state. The kid will keep growing in height slowly, the way kids before puberty just sort of slowly gain in height. And their brains will mature, right? We're not stopping time, Nate, in case that was something you were worried about. We're just pausing the hormone cascades that lead to the non-reversible physical changes of puberty. So the voice isn't going to get any deeper. The Adam's apple isn't going to get any more prominent in someone with the testosterone-driven puberty. The chest isn't going to get any bigger, and the periods, if they've started, they will pause. If they haven't started, they might have one at the start and then it should pause. And so changes that, I mean, the period one can start and stop and start and stop, and there's no visible change. But the other ones, the chest development, the voice change, the physical hair changes, those are all things that once they're established in the body, there's nothing that you can do to reverse that. You can do hair removal, you can do top surgery. Sometimes people will get vocal cord surgery, but all of these things are more invasive, they're more costly, there's more recovery, there's slightly higher risks, right? Surgery, as opposed to not having the thing happen in the first place. And the beauty of puberty blockers is if you stop giving them, the body will restart its puberty. It can take a few months. Sometimes that puberty still isn't wanted, in which case you can put them on other sex hormones if what they're wanting is the opposite to what their body was going to produce in the first place before the blocker. So, what are the risks? Well, for a time, they're not growing as quick as their peers. They're not undergoing those permanent, irreversible physical changes. And their brain maturation that would have happened because of estrogen or testosterone doesn't happen. Now, it's temporary, and there are always a few kids who start going through puberty later in their teens. So is that really a risk, or is that just this is what happens when you pause puberty at a younger age? I guess it depends on what the values of the patient are. You know, what's a harm to them and what's a benefit to them? Leuprolide is the most commonly used one, and it's given as an injection every month or every 3 months, depending on the dose. And this medicine is also used for prostate cancer treatment and for endometriosis treatment. And it's used for severe premenstrual dysphoric disorder. There's a few different circumstances where one might use it, and precocious puberty, which is much less common than gender dysphoria. But there are some kids who just start going through puberty at very, very young ages, and to give them a chance to grow taller and to go through puberty at a time more in common with their peers, they might go on it from, you know, ages 3 and up
Okay.
if they should start puberty at that point. You can imagine how devastating breasts and periods would be on a 3-year-old.
I can't even.
Like we just don't think that that is safe or healthy if the parent and the child both would like not to be having to deal with puberty right after having toilet trained potentially. You can imagine. Okay, so downsides to leuprolide. Well, if you've had hormones around for a while, say it started in an adult, say it started in me, I have endometriosis, imagine, and I get put on leuprolide because nothing else can control my cycles. Well, it's bringing my hormone production down. It's putting me into what feels a lot like the time before period or menopause. Low hormones can be kind of irritable, distractible, forgetful, hot flushes, low sex drive. It's a real problem for someone like me who's had hormones, you know, more than half my life. But for someone who's 9 or 10 or the ages at which we typically start puberty, blocking puberty is a lot less rough because they've only had the hormones around for a while. So, you know, it should just bring them back to the point that they were at beforehand. Yes, there can be some fatigue, there can be some moodiness, there can be some hot flushes if they're a later teen going on it. But generally, those are short-lived. Goes away when you stop taking it. Goes away if you take cross-sex hormones later on. And the benefit is it stops the irreversible change temporarily. It gives the child, or in this case, often the teen, depending on what age they start at, and their support network, so their parents or their guardians, some time to work with their multidisciplinary team of support and figure out what their goals are and what they need to be their healthiest, most fulfilled selves. And so That ability to pause can be really helpful. And the effects are immediate, but there's also some long-term benefits. I talked about all those other, like, permanent and irreversible once they happen changes. Well, if a person gets to a point where they don't need as invasive a top surgery in order to feel comfortable in their body, that can alleviate a lot of distress all through the teen years until they're of an age when they can consent to surgery, but also a much easier time going through that surgery if need be and post-op phase. There's more to what leuprolide can do as far as side effects. Like, bone density gets talked about a lot. I don't know how much you know, Nate, about kids' bones, but they're not very heavy, right? Before puberty, there's still a lot of cartilage around. As adults, our bones have stopped growing, but that in between, there's a whole lot of bone action going on. And if you put someone on puberty blockers and you leave them on there for a long period of time, they're just not laying down good, healthy bone the same way. What that tells me is that eventually everybody must undergo a puberty, whether that's your own initial, what you were going to do anyway, or puberty with the opposite sex hormone, one or the other. And we know we can tell kids while they're on puberty blockers, take your vitamin D, get your calcium, participate in all the sports. We encourage kids to be physically active. These are things that their whole lives will help them to have good, healthy bones. And by the time we worry about someone's bone density as far as fracture risk, Nate, they're in their menopausal years. They're in their 50s and their 60s. They have a lifetime to build up bones before we start to see fracture risk go up. Do I have patients who are on leuprolide when they were kids, who are now osteoporosis age? Like, no, I don't. We might be seeing slightly earlier risk of fracture going up. But again, we have their whole lives to address osteoporosis risk factors. Puberty is 2 or 3 years, and we can really make a difference. And we see it when they come in to follow up. The parents tell us how their kid is doing, the kid tells us how the kid is doing. And we see it every day in my office, because I get to work with this many gender dysphoric patients, puberty blockers given at the right time, which is during puberty and not many years after puberty, change everything for a kid and for everybody who cares about that kid and for that adult when they're an adult. So, to my mind, that's why I was only half joking when you said puberty blockers and then you kind of paused to gather yourself. And I was just like, I love them. They're great. We should have very low thresholds. Honestly, they're really, really safe, Nate. They're very, very safe. Are they perfect? No, nothing in healthcare is perfect. If we required perfect risk, we wouldn't be able to do anything with anybody. And there's no reason why gender dysphoria should be treated any differently than any other health concern. We shouldn't hold it to some very, very high standard of perfection. When I hear 1 to 2% of people might regret their gender affirming surgery, to me, that sounds like 98% are satisfied. That's better than almost anything else I get to do in medicine. And those satisfaction rates are real. I see them in my office. I can't show you a randomized controlled trial because I just don't. It's not ethical for me to randomize people to being affirmed or to not being affirmed in their health care. I wouldn't do that to you. I don't want it for my own care. So, yeah, I think I kind of lost my own thread there.
No, I think you covered a lot of ground, and most of it, like you knocked off like 4 or 5 questions that I had on the subject of puberty blockers. So I do have one more though, because this is another one of those myths, let's say. Who gets to decide? Like, if a let's say 10-year-old who started puberty, who is experiencing some of the gender incongruity. Let's say that they come in and they say, I'm not I would like the puberty blockers, please. Is that something that a 10-year-old right now gets to decide on their own? Is there a consultation with parents or grandparents? Does Daniel Smith come by and sit in the office? How does this work right now?
So far, Premier Smith has not shown up in my office. I welcome her to come down and visit with me anytime she would like to talk about my work and the patients that I get to see. Yeah, she won't see any actual patients. They would have to consent beforehand to that sort of thing. But to answer your question, so who gets to decide for a 10-year-old? I love that you gave me a 10-year-old. So at age 10, I would never expect to see this person on their own. They can't drive themselves to my office. Someone had to book the appointment. Okay. So, who's ever coming with this 10-year-old, I will be meeting them for the first time. I want to know who's in your life, right? Who do you live with? Are there other parents that you live with some of the time? Like, who's the guardians? Who's got decision-making capacity? So a 10-year-old, it's kind of like a newborn. The parents have the full decision-making capacity for that patient. Many parents, and you've mentioned it, and some of your guests have mentioned it lately, 62% of trans and gender diverse youth say they've got affirming home environments. So let's assume 62% of patients of that 10-year-old are going to be supportive of listening to and responding to what's my kid telling me that they need. Now, 10-year-olds want a lot of things. I've had kids that were 10 at one time. They didn't get everything they wanted. But if a parent comes in with their co-parent and their 10-year-old and they all say, "You need to listen to my kid, Jillian. This is so and so," they would like not to be going through what they're going through, then if we're all able to, like any healthcare appointment, talk about their concerns, figure out what their goals are, what do they expect from the visit, and if part of that is a discussion around puberty and puberty blockers, then we're gonna get into it. We're gonna talk about the risks and the potential benefits, how they work, how it's given, how long you can be on it for, what we have to be mindful of. And if everybody's on the same page, it's still the parents I'm turning to for, are you consenting? The 10-year-old, it's a 10-year-old, they're participating in the discussion. If this child doesn't give assent, say, "Yes, I would like to try that injection once a month, please, Dr. Jillian," then I might not be able to proceed, even if the parents were fully on board with it, right? So, parents as the consenting party and the patient as the assenting party. Now, if it's a 10-year-old or a 16-year-old and they're developmentally, I don't know the term, I'm sorry. If there's challenges to their ability to assent, it's going to go beyond Jillian and the parents and the patient, right? We're going to involve other wiser minds. We have the META program in Calgary. I have a community of practice of people that I turn to when I'm like, I've got a complicated situation. Like, who can give me some guidance on what to do next? But yeah, say it's a healthy 10-year-old who's having a really hard time with their puberty so far, and they got good parent support and parents are on board. Parents make the decision. Now, what if it's, no, wait, don't anticipate his questions. Wait, you word your question so beautifully.
No, that's good. I just want to clarify. So the way that you're describing it, if a 10-year-old was to come in and say, "I have nobody else with me, but I'd like some puberty blockers, please," I assume that your reaction would probably be along the lines of, "Let's call the police." But if a 10-year-old comes in with their parents and the 10-year-old says, "I would really like some puberty blockers, please," and the parents say, "Hell no, that kid isn't going to get the puberty blockers." Conversely, if a 10-year-old comes in with their parents and the parents say, "We've been watching something on YouTube and we think our kid should get puberty blockers and the kid says, hell no, then that kid's not getting puberty blockers either. So you've got to have everybody on the same page with the parents making what's the word I'm looking, the phrase that I'm looking for here. Parental choice, I think might be the turn of phrase I'm looking to use. It's the parents who are exercising the parental choice in with the kid being like, yeah, no, I want this in order for the puberty blockers to even be on the table. Am I getting that right?
Yes, Nate, you got it. You nailed it.
Look at me
The
go.
parents' choice. And so, if there's a big disconnect between what the parents want and what the kids want in any healthcare decision, it always needs to go beyond. Because parents have the right to raise their kids and to teach their kids what they believe, but kids have rights to healthcare. And so the parents are expected to act in the best interest of the child. And so, there are definitely situations where not everybody is on the same page. And that makes it a lot more complex.
I can
And
imagine.
yeah.
Now, when does that equation, if you will, change? I mean, we have Daniel Smith saying no puberty blockers before 15, which is everybody and their dog who seems to have any kind of idea of how these things are used, goes, well, that defeats the point of them. But let's say that a 15-year-old comes in and they say, I would like to get some puberty blockers. Because I'd like some ineffectual medicine, please. What's the parents' involvement at that point?
It really depends in the case of a 15-year-old. And it's not like you hit a magic age and suddenly we just see the teen by themselves. There's this gradient of decision-making capacity, and as we get older, again, assuming like a average healthy teenager, the more time and the more we have a chance to get to know them, the better we're able to educate them on whatever is the healthcare that we're talking about. We do an assessment of capacity. So, if a minor patient, so that's someone below age 18 in Alberta, of adolescence, so somewhere between 12 and 14, we start to ask if we can have part of the appointment, just the patient and the doctor. And the vast majority of parents are happy to, like, yes, this is your time to practice being your own advocate with the doctor in the room. And then they'll go wait in the waiting room and we'll ask whatever questions you might want to ask a child teen without their parents present. And so when it comes to decision making around something like puberty blockers, which are at 15, not often that helpful. But other things, if a child, teenager, can understand all of the pertinent information to the decision, and the more complicated the decision, the more risky something is, or the more life-altering the outcomes, the more rigorous you have to be in determining if they have that capacity. But generally speaking, somewhere between 14 and 16, adolescents start to make more and more of their own healthcare decisions. And whenever possible, that 62% of them, they're going to be bringing in their parents because they want their parents there to advocate for and with them and to hear them out. But you hear parents and you see teens more and more saying, it's his body. It's his choice, right? I'm just here making sure that, we know what's involved and supporting my kid. And so we don't have that hard age cutoff. We have somewhere that they are a mature minor. They understand the decision that they're being asked to make or that they're asking to make. And then if they show that they have enough understanding and they want to consent to or not consent to something, they have that power. And so, like, I've heard it a few times since these policies were first announced in that timeshare video. We don't actually have this like hard cutoff of 18. It's not entirely the parents until 18 or until any specific age. But I mean, my preference is we've got everybody on board. Obviously, that's a very simple situation. If you got one parent with the child and another parent opposed, that can get more technically challenging and, legal, which is never fun for someone non-legal minded like me in healthcare. But the important part of the discussion is like what matters to the patient, the choice that they're asking to make, that their decision that they're making, they're also responsible for the consequences. So we try to make sure that, people know things take time, everyone's outcomes are unique. We can kind of predict some of the effects of a treatment, but we don't know exactly how it's going to look or feel for you until you're going through it. And the thing with hormones, Nate, I don't know if you know this, but they work slowly and gradually for the most part. It's not like you start taking them today and you're Barry White tomorrow. Okay, some people won't get that reference. Like your voice doesn't just drop overnight. Your top doesn't develop into breasts overnight. And so we don't just one off and then send them back out into the universe with their prescription for blockers or hormones. We're following up. We're checking in. We're seeing, what do you feel? How do you feel? And what is it that you like so far, or what's happening that you're not comfortable with? And we troubleshoot. And it's not like, I think the premier said this at one point, something about like the minute that you're on it, it's blockers and hormones and surgery, and
Oh, you're
it
on
moves
an
really
irreversible
quickly.
path. It's a highway
Right.
to hell.
Right. Like you move really quickly once you're on it. And I thought, like, in no way, I try to be efficient, Nate. I try not to have long wait time, but our best efforts, in no way is any of this quick, is any of this simple to access and negotiate your way through. And at no point do we say, oh, you're on it, kid. There's no getting off this train. Like, no. We're trying to make it like everything healthcare. See, here's what I think really what we should do is not write policy that interfere with the physician and the patient discussing important health concerns and coming up with a patient-centered plan of care. Like, because the patient knows who they are better than anyone. And there might still be questions and unknowns, but they've got their own values and expectations, right? And their experiences. And me, the physician, I know some things about what these medicines do. I know some things about what surgery involves. But like, we come together on things. We really don't have any room in the room for people who have no understanding of what time puberty happens, or of what this patient is experiencing and why they're here, what is bothering them about what's going on already. Yeah, there's no need to write policy on this. This is healthcare. We don't write policy about at what age it's okay for you to have your first colonoscopy.
I mean, that took a turn, no pun intended. But one of the other things that I want to just touch on real quick, because I know this is one of the talking points that gets used, is some people have gone down the road of saying, oh, I don't know if I think that those doctors should be making the determination as to whether or not these people have the ability to make these decisions. And that's a fascinating argument for me because I just go to like forms. Like, have you ever heard of a form one? Because one of the things that physicians are trusted with and they're responsible for is determining competency and capacity. And one of the powers that exists with physicians, and it should, to be clear, I'm not saying it shouldn't, because Sometimes that power needs to be exercised, but is to determine whether or not somebody has the competency and capacity to make their own decisions. And it's a process. It's one that I'm very glad that I, as a paramedic, can't do because I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. But it is a responsibility, and it's a responsibility that physicians do take very seriously. So the notion that a physician doesn't have the ability to determine whether or not a 16-year-old kid has competency and capacity, like, if you don't think a physician has the ability to do that, then you need to deal with how do they do all of the form stuff for the geriatric population or for the people who are dealing with mental health issues, because it's the same thing. It's just being utilized on different groups. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think the only thing that's different here, Nate, is some people think trans and gender diversity is its own mystical special case, or they don't think it should be, or they don't think people who are gender diverse should get to be themselves publicly. They're fine with them being in the closet and not changing their name or their pronouns or accessing any affirming care until it's way past the time when, for instance, those puberty blockers would be helpful. But those same people who might say, well, who am I to determine if a 16-year-old can make a decision about that? They're probably the same people who don't worry about a 16-year-old's ability to consent to strep treatment with penicillin. But they might worry about that 16-year-old's ability to consent to contraception or sexually transmitted infection screening, or heaven forbid, an abortion for that pregnancy that they didn't want to keep. So that argument comes from a place of control and wanting to make gender diversity the problem rather than the person who wishes to have control over parts of the population's healthcare is the real problem.
Here's another little thought exercise that I wanted to run by you before I get to the big question. The way that you've described puberty blockers and hormone therapy, not only are they having, I mean, you said the difference that it makes for these patients is tremendous, but you've also very clearly illustrated that it also prevents the need for greater intervention down the road. Do you think, here's the question, do you think that there is an argument to be made that these treatments, these medicines, are in fact a form of preventative care?
Yes, I think that these medicines are a form of harm reduction for real, for real. Puberty blockers, more than anything, work best when they're given at the right time. And so, yes, preventative healthcare means being proactive with kids. It means before they even get into my office, like, I sure hope those kids all have good comprehensive sex education, Nate. Whether they get it at home or at school, as long as they get that information that, you know what, people are different. You're going to run into people in the world who are different than you think, and be open-minded and respectful. And you never know which kid is going to be that 1 in 100 kids who says, actually, that's me. And someday, you know, they're gonna come in and see me. And so the earlier we get to meet kids and families who have gender questioning, if it's before puberty, it's a lovely doctor's visit, Nate. My job is so great because I just get to listen to these families and interact with these kids like any healthy kid checkup. And we might talk a bit about, like, we're trying to figure out how to negotiate the social transition piece at school, or we're trying to figure out how to let grandma and grandpa know that, you know, Fiona would like to be called Fiona. Thank you very much. And like the medicine piece is really not medicine at all. It's all of the social support. And Then, as time goes on, we start to plan for the future and what happens when and what are we going to do when. And so, when I get kids coming in ahead of the game, before changes have happened that make them physically uncomfortable, life is good. Life is easy. Yeah. And I wish that I had, same day availability for every time that someone comes in who's just gotten past the point of comfort, right? Where it's like, now my kid is distressed and doesn't come out of their room for the whole time that they have their period or whatever their term is for it, right? And now what do we do, Jillian? And so, yeah, it is preventative healthcare. We can prevent a lot of distress and a lot of harm by meeting kids and families where they need to be met. And that's one of the most distressing pieces about this whole basket of policy. I know I haven't read it because it hasn't been written, because it hasn't had the consultation part done yet.
Oh, it's been broadly consulted.
Like, I don't even know if they've framed the problem that they're trying to address with it, frankly, Nate. But like, from what I hear in videos, for example, and when she's given interviews, like with Vashi, fantastic interview, it really strikes me. I totally lost my train of thought there. Wow.
That's okay. I gotta jump in with the
Come back.
where I was gonna take the preventative question.
Okay.
Do you find it at all dissonant that someone who, I don't know, would maybe make the argument that somebody who, I don't know, gets to stage four cancer could have perhaps done more and been more proactive with their treatment would roll out this policy set? Is that dissonant to you?
Well, yes, incredibly so. Incredibly so. Okay. Let's get back to like good medicine involves, a lot of history taking, a little bit of education, and then maybe some prescribing, right? So, like, if you've got something that can prevent later, more serious effects, and it's fairly safe, and it works best when you give it on time, then you give it on time and then you reevaluate things, right? She's talking about, the kids in sports question or the adults in sports question, like all of those purported differences, which do go away within the first 2 years of being on affirming hormone treatment. Thank you very much. And we need all of our kids active and participating in the world, all of our kids, gender diverse or not, like we need our kids to be interacting with each other. That can involve sports. Sports can be great for human development, right? But if she's truly worried about some believed difference between the genders in the sports, like again, don't block puberty blockers for puberty. If the intention, Nate, is to improve outcomes for gender diverse kids, none of these policies would happen. What would happen is we would be putting more thought and care and resources into networking the people like me so that we could better deliver the necessary services to the families that need it. Instead, we've got incredible charities like Skipping Stone Foundation operating without any kind of provincial government sort of support or acknowledgement. We would have no need for my raft of otters on WhatsApp and Zoom, a community of practice of people working in gender affirming everything coming together to support each other because we would have some kind of a formalized network. We know, well, we have people, okay, I'm not the only one, right? There are people who have ideas and knowledge on how we can better look after our gender diverse Albertans. And none of that looks like policy to make arbitrary age cutoffs on medical care. That's not something that happens in any medical care, right? It's not fit for purpose.
I want to get into the big dumb question. And I'm going to preface this by saying the question that I'm about to ask you is unmitigatingly stupid. Okay. So I'm going to brace myself. You brace yourself. We'll take a moment and then I'll do it. We have seen people who have very close affiliations with Danielle Smith, even still, despite the fact that they've apparently been told to delete their Twitter account and, or sorry, their X account. It'll always be Twitter to me. She still has these affiliations with these people and others who share these views and espouse these views. So, to be clear, how many children's genitals have you personally mutilated?
So, for the podcasters who don't get to see my face, I just had to take a deep breath and school myself. I don't like talking about anyone's health procedure using that term because there's lots of people, Nate, who've had to have lots of surgeries done for lots of health reasons. And I don't ever want anyone to hear that and think, oh, was I mutilated because I had my testicle removed for testicle cancer or what have you. But I understand where you're coming from with this question. So, to answer, I mean, I'm not a surgeon, right? I have had one patient who was a newborn who was born with intersex genitalia, and the parents had counseling from the providers that were looking after this family. I was just the family doctor, so I received the reports, but I wasn't involved in the discussions. The parents, like parents do for their newborn children, made the decision that they made as far as whether to have gender or not genitalia altering surgery according to what they understood was the problem and what they valued for their child, in hopes that they made the right decision that this kid would agree to in the future when they were able to give voice to it. So I wasn't involved in the decision. It's happened to one of my patients. I have had a few families who had their baby boys circumcised, right? That, again, none of the babies had any say in it. But yeah, no other surgeries are happening on children's genitalia or teenagers' genitalia. That is not something that is accessible or available in Alberta or in Canada. Like 18 and up, thank you very much. There is a process. I'm afraid it takes a long time, many steps to get in. Yes, so does that answer your question, Nate?
It does. And I apologize for asking it in that particular way, but that is the rhetoric that we keep hearing from people who are being gross about this issue. And so I wanted to just drop it right there and let you do exactly what you did with it, because it's just not true. Like, it's just not. And do you think, I'll ask the question this way. Do you think that there would be value for people in positions of leadership to say that's not true, that's not happening, if they talked to people who are actually providing this kind of care?
Yes, I think people in leadership can say children are not having their genitals operated on for gender dysphoria reasons in Canada. Period. Full stop. End of sentence.
Thank you very much. I find it so mind-boggling that these conversations are necessary, but this is something that people have repeated as recently as 48 hours ago. And these are people who have a very high profile. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important. And I'm so grateful that you're willing to have this conversation and say, no, I'm the person who's actually doing the care, and that's not a thing. Give your head a shake. You might not say it exactly like that, but I will. So, Yeah, so let's talk about the surgery piece. We've seen some statistics that Vashi got. I think there were, for the most recent numbers, eight top surgeries that were done for anybody under the age of 18. But what does the surgical path? I mean, you kind of alluded there. It's not a fast thing, which kind of shockingly, he said sarcastically for the audio listeners, is in contrast to what the premier said in her timeshare in the Lake of Fire video. What does the surgical path actually look like? So somebody comes to you, they were doing puberty blockers, we'll go with 10 again because I like consistency. They did puberty blockers from 10 till whenever it was appropriate for them to switch to hormone therapy. They've been in your care for X number of years. And they say, you know what? I want to go ahead and I want to get the surgery. What does that look like? I imagine they are just coming into your office one day and being like, surprise. But for most of them, I'm speaking in generalities and I probably shouldn't. But what does that process look like?
Okay. So transmasculine and non-binary patients who were assigned female at birth and didn't have access to puberty blockers early enough, who have chest development that they're not comfortable with. Some of them come in, and the very first appointment, they're already talking about top surgery knee. Like, this is a very visible, and for some of us, this is something that cannot be sort of easily covered up, easily kept quiet. What's in your pants, it's a little bit more possible to live with. Okay, my biases as a breasted person, I have to say, they can be a health problem, even if it's not because of your gender. And so, yeah, when someone comes in and they're already talking about top surgery, most cases, like with everything, gender dysphoric youth, in the majority of cases that I get to see, because they had someone come to the office with them, the parents are fully engaged and on board and supportive. And honestly, if your cisgender masculine child had developed breasts, as often happens in puberty, and wanted to do something about it so that they could mow the lawn in a tank top or go to the beach in swim trunks and nothing else, we shouldn't have a hesitation about doing something about that. And I'm afraid there just isn't a medicine for this, right? There's surgery, and then there is wearing a binder or appropriately binding in a safe way with good, medical support and follow-up. And so, say someone comes in and they're 14 and they're like, okay, here's what I really need. Top surgery is what I really need. Cool, great. I'm afraid in Alberta, there's no one accepting referrals for top surgery younger than age 18 in the publicly funded system. This isn't because we have a policy or a law that says that they can't. And the guidelines, the WPATH Standards of Care 8, talk about age 16 as appropriate for some kinds of surgery, like top surgery, where they would recommend, 18 or the age of majority in whatever country you're in as the recommended age to start pursuing bottom surgery. And so, some parts of the world, 16 is the, like, you have to be 16 to get top surgery, because that was the age of consent in places that had like a firm age cutoff for consent, right? And so we used to have, and you've heard the numbers, like there would be eight surgeries for gender dysphoria in patients younger than age 18 in Alberta in the last, was it the last year or 2 years?
I want to say it was 2021 that those numbers were for, but I could be getting, it was either 2021 or 2022. I mean, makes a huge difference either way.
I mean, it's a tiny, tiny number of cases that were done, right? And yes, they're under 18, but we don't know if they were 17 and a half, right? And if I can get a patient who has gynecomastia, cis male, who is 14, to have top surgery, why can't I get a patient who's gender dysphoric and 16 or 17 to have top surgery. Like, again, this is where we're taking gender diversity and pathologizing it. This is where we're treating it like its own very different, very special, because people have their own biases against it and think that they should have a say in what healthcare people get. I mean, I know gender diverse people are a small number of Albertans, but this is about all of our healthcare needs. This is no time is it okay for us to have policy without medical support, without the support of the population that is involved, that the care is being given to, policy that prevents appropriate healthcare from being available to patients who need it. Like, this should chill all of us, whether you have a close family member or friends or patients who are trans or not. But back to the trans question, like, so say 10 years ago, I might have had one or two kids who were under age 18 who were seeing the Mayo Clinic, who got referred to a plastic surgeon after, getting a letter of recommendation from their psychiatrist at the Mayo Clinic, who was able to access affirming top surgery younger than age 18. It's a tiny number of the ones who want it, who need it, who have excellent support networks advocating for them to get it. I don't have the power to make it happen any sooner. I can't even refer. Okay, so Nate, we got surgeons who will take a referral for a patient who is 18 for top surgery for gender dysphoria, but their wait time is 2 years. And that's if you get a surgeon who's willing to accept the referral and put them on their wait list. Can I refer them at 16, knowing that in 2 years they still won't have seen them? No, they must be 18 at the time of referral. Because reasons. Presumably, some pressure has been brought to the surgeons, or they're just that busy. But, like, this isn't based on medical necessity. This isn't based on what's best for the mental health and social development of that person or that population. This isn't even based in law right now. It's just, this is the climate, the environment that we're operating in.
Can I ask you two more stupid questions?
Please do. I love your questions. I'm loving this, by the
So,
way.
as you were talking, if we view, as we should, I think, gender affirming surgery through the lens of this can be medically appropriate surgery for medically appropriate patients, is how I'm going to try to tiptoe through that. There's no rules about implants in these policies. So, like, if I'm, let's say that I'm a trans 16, I'm going to screw this up. I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm going to screw this up. Let's say that I was born male presenting and I began the process of puberty blockers and hormone therapy and I decide that I want to get implants at 16, or like, are there rules about like what age you can get implants? Or is it just like take all the hormones and hope for the best?
I don't know of any rules.
I wonder what the stats are on that.
That's a fascinating question, Nate. I hope you get an answer to that because, yeah, I honestly don't know. And I suspect that's a question that would only happen between the patient and the surgeon. I don't expect that that is funded provincially. And so it would be privately paid. Someone would be paying out of pocket, in which case you can self-refer. Now, sometimes surgeons, when the patient is young, they will want a referral from a healthcare provider for a procedure. But I have never been involved in those discussions when someone goes for breast augmentation or breast implants. That's never something that needs a family doctor involved. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've referred a couple of my transfeminine patients who were eligible. These were all over the age of 18 who didn't have sufficient breast development with hormone therapy appropriately done for a long enough period of time. We refer them to have surgery to for augmentation mammoplasty, it's called. But yeah, none of those have been
Like,
underage.
nobody seems
It's
upset about
going to
that.
be acceptable. Pardon?
Nobody seems upset about that. And that, like, that's, I mean, I don't know, maybe slightly telling, and it leads into my next question. There was a thing, and I'm gonna do the standard privilege, cisgender white male disclosure here, but there was a thing that the premier has said a couple of times now, and I worry about the implications of it. And you're a family physician as well, so I'm going to take advantage of your expertise here. But she has said, you know, we just don't want these young girls, she insists on calling them, to get the top surgery and then not to be able to enjoy the full breadth and depth of motherhood. And she has used the example of breastfeeding specifically a couple of times now. And there's a part of me that hears that and goes, I don't know what the message that sends is to a mother who can't breastfeed. Because if you're saying that the whole experience of being a mother is tied exclusively to, or not exclusively, but it tied in any way in the ability to successfully breastfeed, which from what I've heard, I have no personal firsthand experience that I can speak of my own. I haven't done like the Peter Griffin or nothing like that, but from what I've heard, it can be really hard. And sometimes it just doesn't work. And that's not a fault of the mother. But is there a subtext to this rhetoric that Smith is using, that if you can't breastfeed, then you're not a real mom, that maybe we should talk about a little bit?
I do think that bears talking about for sure, Nate. For one, you're right. It does a great disservice to everybody who is cisgender and female and doesn't breastfeed or bear children or does bear children and tries or doesn't try to breastfeed. There is no wrong way to be a cisgender woman. Truly, people who have these fixed notions of how to perform gender appropriately are the same ones who won't let gender diverse people declare who they are and perform themselves in a way that's authentic to them. And so, yeah, it's very telling, I think, for her to say things like, if they're not sexually active yet, they don't know what kind of how they're going to be, they're making choices about. And all of that is like, well, they live in their bodies all the time. And so, you know, maybe these are things they can think about, but not something that someone else who has an idea how they should enjoy their bodies or not gets to have a say. We don't have to perform the same way when we're cis. And it is not fair that we make gender diverse people sort of conform to our notions. That's hypocritical.
Yeah, like to me, her saying that was the equivalent of like somebody walking into like one of those breastfeeding rooms in the mall or whatever, and being like, "Oh my God, you're bottle feeding, you're not breastfeeding." And I think that most people would look at that and go like, "Wow, you're kind of a not good person." But because we're using it in the context of trans care, all of a sudden it's totally acceptable. And I don't think it is. And so I just wanted to make sure, because I have no standing.
We've heard from dozens of organizations who have said these policies, these statements that are being made are not acceptable. You're not alone in saying that's not okay to say. It's coming from many different voices, thankfully, and hopefully the chorus will just continue to grow until either these policies are just swept away, or there's actual consultation and an actual real what is the problem we're trying to address is identified so that we can go about, improving things for gender diverse Albertans.
I would also just like to point out that very early on in this conversation, I got something wrong and you corrected me and we were still able to have a conversation. And I don't feel like I'm any less for being wrong and admitting it. I'm not saying that there are people at the highest levels of elected office in this province who can maybe give it a try. I'm just talking is all I'm doing here.
I like that you said that we're allowed to make mistakes, Nate. Even positions of great power don't make us immune to occasionally, shit the bed. And real leadership is when you recognize you erred and you listen to the advice of people who might know better what you're trying to talk about and actually help you pronounce it correctly or get it, frame it right. Again, if you don't know, if you think you know what the problem is, and everyone you're talking about is saying, no, that's not the problem. Here's the issue. You can listen and, whoops, got it wrong. We'll try again and show that you're smart and professional and able to correct course. Or you can stick to your guns and go out in a blaze of glory.
You know, I think some people, I'm not sure who, have romanticized former Premier Ralph Klein for a similar sentiment of when you make a mistake, the best thing to do is own it and move on. I don't know. Dr. Demonte, I'm going to give you the floor. Is there anything else you want to say? Anything else you want to throw out there?
Yes, I do. I do. I want to say, Premier Smith, Danielle, we're both busy women. If you want to do something to improve conditions for Albertans, in particular trans and gender diverse Albertans, you have a province full of expertise and lived experiences. And all you need to do is listen and be willing to admit that this needs some reworking. I'm happy to talk more anytime. And for all of those people whose healthcare is being talked about today and your voices aren't here on the show with us today, just want you to know you're not alone. Premier Smith was right. You are precious. You're worth being here and part of this conversation. Or telling us to just shut up because it's none of our business talking about your business. And I want you to know the healthcare is still going on the way that it always has. It hasn't stopped. There's nothing in place that's changed. And we're not, those of us trying to do this work and get it right aren't going to stop working at getting this right. And if that includes influencing policy or scrapping the policy, we got lots of hands in this work. That's,
Awesome.
yeah.
Awesome. I know what the promo clip for this episode is going to be now. Dr. Damani, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat tonight. I want to thank you so much for sharing your experience and your expertise. It is tremendously appreciated. And thank you for your patience with my stupid and sometimes infuriating questions.
Nate, it's been such a treat. Thank you very much for having me on.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content.
whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms. We want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of the Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.